like us to read three passages. The first is in Psalm 51. Verse 12, restore unto me the joy of thy salvation, and uphold me with thy free spirit. Then will I teach transgressors thy ways, and sinners shall be converted unto thee. Now verse 18, do good in thy good pleasure unto Zion, build thou the walls of Jerusalem. Then shalt thou be pleased with the sacrifices of righteousness, with burnt offering and whole burnt offering. Then shall they offer bullocks upon thine altar. Now I want to read in the prophecy of Isaiah, and chapter 38, I think it is. Verse 9 of chapter 38, the writing of Hezekiah, king of Judah, when he had been sick and was recovered of his sickness. I said, in the cutting off of my days, I shall go to the gates of the grave. I am deprived of the residue of my years. Now, verse 20. The Lord was ready to save me. Therefore, we will sing my songs to the stringed instruments all the days of our life in the house of the Lord. For Isaiah had said, let them take a lump of figs and lay it for a plaster upon the boil, and he shall recover, and so on. Now I want to read in the little prophecy of Jonah. Chapter 2. These are familiar verses, of course. Then Jonah prayed unto the Lord his God out of the fish's belly. Now verse number 7. When my soul fainted within me, I remembered the Lord, and my prayer came in unto thee, unto thine holy temple. They that observe lying vanities forsake their own mercy. But I will sacrifice unto thee with a voice of thanksgiving. I will pay that that I have vowed. Salvation is of the Lord. And the Lord spake unto the fish, and it vomited out Jonah upon the dry land. That will do for reading. I would say that, generally speaking, when we're reading these passages of our Bible, our minds are almost exclusively taken up with the individuals that are involved. In them we have three men at the very point of death, because of certain difficulties. David, as you know, without me telling you, that he passed the sentence of death upon himself when the story was told to him about the sheep and so on, and about the lamb that was stolen. He says, yes, the man that did this should be dead. And he was spared and kept alive. Hezekiah, he had a sentence of death put on him, and he was spared and kept alive. And Jonah was thrown over the side of the ship, and I don't believe a mariner ever thought he survived. He likely, they never thought that he'd ever see another day as they cast him overboard. Now he was dead, and yet he's alive. In other words, we might say we have three men who, in a certain sense, are like alive from the dead. Now what you would likely be interested in, and I hope you are, I wonder why. Stories like this of Hezekiah appears in the middle of a prophecy. And why, for example, is the whole book of Jonah a story of a man and his exercise and his doings? And it's in the prophets. You nearly think it should be in the historical books. You nearly think God should have put it somewhere else. And anyone reading through the prophecy of Isaiah will be amazed to find that these chapters in the middle of Isaiah are what we call historical. Now, there's a reason for that, and that's the bit I want to mention. In all three cases, the example is given to us in our Bible as an illustration of Israel's future recovery. Let us be sure about it. The greatest revival that will ever be known on earth is coming. And what's that to somebody? The revival of Israel as a nation and bringing them back into fellowship with God. And these individual experiences were men allowed, now get this well into our minds, allowed to have personal experiences that will be in keeping with the nation in a coming day. Now I think that's most important. To me, it's very, very, very significant that God allows men to have certain experiences and certain strange experiences. And we often wonder why he brings them into those. It was a very strange experience that Abraham had on the Mount Moriah when he brought his only son. Why was God bringing a mortal man into that? Sure, anybody knows, you'd say, well, sure, didn't God know he would never let his, Isaac be slain on the altar? Didn't God know this and didn't God know that? And why did he ever let his servant take that awful experience of tramping that hill with his only son beside him and with the knife in his hand and the fire beside him? You'd wonder what it's all about. But you see, God was bringing a mortal man into line with his thoughts so that a man would feel as near as he could. Now, it's limited, but as near as he could to what God felt when he gave his only son. In other words, dear children of God, I hope we're wise enough to know that one of the wonders of our existence on earth and one of the reasons why we're spared is that we might have certain experiences in our life that bring us into a knowledge of other experiences far beyond human minds to understand. We're little, in a little measure, now in a little measure, and in our own measure, passing through these experiences. Now, if you will allow me to apply for a minute, now don't be too sharp if I get a wee bit off the lines, but will you allow me for a minute or two to apply certain principles to our hearts tonight? If Israel is, and I hope you all believe this, if you don't, you should, that's all I can say, that Israel will be restored as a nation. And I hope you do believe that much of our Bible is taken up with that wonderful future day for Israel. I hope we believe that. And I hope and trust we believe that God is waiting for that very time when the people that apparently are set aside and are disowned at the present time will be back where they should be, in the forefront of the nations, and will be a wonderful testimony for God. Now that's great, and that's worth thinking about. And you see, just as Israel as a nation needs recovery and restoration, God's assemblies and God's people and his present testimony is constantly in need of revival. Now, you may not believe it. I'm not saying you do. But I personally believe that in California there would be need to be revival among the Lord's dear people. I'm not saying it's coming, but it would need to come. I believe that there's a great, vast need of in the work of God in our land, in this land. It isn't many lands. We needn't be thinking that you're unique in any sense. But we could really do with a precious revival. And we would need to learn, if we can, from our Bible, how that comes about. Oh, you say, that's big talk. Well, it might be, but I hope it'll get big results. And sure, we wouldn't mind big talk if it is going to bring about results. What do you say? What results would you like to see? I'd like to see something of that spirit brought in amongst us that was in the heart of David when God restored him. Now listen to it again. Restore unto me the joy of thy salvation, and then will I teach transgressors thy ways, and sinners will be converted unto thee. And as you all know, that in Psalm 32, he was actually fulfilling that very expression, for he does in that very psalm teach the transgressors the ways of the Lord. Now we need to learn certain simple, very solemn lessons from our Bible. One is this, that if David is going to know the joys of salvation, he's going to have an experience of honest confession of past failure. Now, is it not significant, brother? Now, I hope we all understand this, that we're not blaming God now for David's sin. Now, don't you be going home and saying we are. But he did allow David to have an experience that is in keeping with the very nation that he represented. That, to me, is very weighty. You know, sometimes it's hard to explain our experiences. Maybe you can do it all right, and maybe you're clearer in your mind than I am. But sometimes it's hard to explain. I couldn't explain to you why I'm here tonight. I could not, be honest about it. If you'd have told me 6 weeks ago that I'd one day be in California, I wouldn't have believed it. And don't be getting frightened now. I'm not daft altogether, but that was really an unreasonable, an unexpected experience for me. And I hope you're realizing this. But you see, God brings us into certain experiences. And he makes us pass through certain things. And those very experiences fit us for being sympathetic to others who were in similar experiences. I can tell you this much. If David had met a child of God that had done something wrong, that had grieved God and grieved his own soul, he could have sat down beside him in a way that very few could. And he could pass the word on to him that would have felt, because he'd been through the mill himself. And having come through the mill himself, he was fitted by the living God to be a help to others. And he could put into them truth that they would never have heard from others. For he had been down in the valley of humble confession and of frank acknowledgement and confession, not only of his sins, but with a desire in his breast that a new heart would be given him, that he would never do the same thing again, and that he'd be preserved and delivered. In other words, we're getting very, very humble at what we're wanting to get at. If you want true revival, and we all long for it. Now we do, brethren. We long for things that are more divine and more spiritual amongst us. If we're going to have that, we begin with honest, humble confession of our failure and of our sin. We don't maybe like to face that. And you say, but sure, I'm doing nothing wrong. And I make no mistakes, and I do everything as scriptural as I can, and all that type of stuff. We can blow ourselves up to the sky if we like, but when all's said and done, God knows us. And God knows our weaknesses, and God knows our failures, and God knows our worldliness. Now he does. He can see when the affections of the breast are being attached to the things of earth. And he knows that we need to humble ourselves and admit that we're not the spiritual believers that we need to be or should be or ought to have been. And we haven't done as well as we should have done. And God brought David to that very point where he was just in using his own words. And mind you, he wasn't doing it in a substitutionary way. He didn't know what he was doing, but he's honestly confessing his sin and will have left the very expressions in the word of God that the nation can take up on a coming day and use them before God in their confession in that day of restoration. You know, if you were reading some of the commentators, maybe you don't do that over in America. I don't know what you do here. You maybe read a little of them. They'll tell you, look, there's something wrong with these closing verses of Psalm 51, for they don't fit the rest of the psalm. And there's somebody has thrown these in by accident or something, and they've just nearly fell out of their place and all that. And they nearly think, you see, that the poor psalmist was all a kind of a stupid or someone when he was writing this, or ever wrote it at all. For you know, they nearly even questioned that. Building the walls of Jerusalem, what has that got to do with Psalm 51 and the confession of the sin of the evil? And all this is a mention of the day that they'll offer sacrifices and so on, and burnt offerings that are acceptable to God. Look, say, it's getting to the very point I want to show you. And that is this. It's the nation of Israel that will actually fulfill the very end of the psalm. And we'll actually see Jerusalem built up and the wall built up. And they'll see sacrifices and offerings going on the altar that will be acceptable to God in that coming day. Oh, says somebody, surely, man, you must never have read Hebrews. I'm talking about sacrifices in a coming day. And you must never have read the half of your Bible. Well, we have a wee bit of look at it. Don't be too hard on us. And we've had an odd look at it. And we've seen things maybe as well as most people along those lines. Now, we have no doubt whatever. Listen to it. That the work of Christ at Calvary was finished once and for all. But you meet on a Sunday morning. A Lord's Day morning, as you would call it here. And unless I'm mistaken, you'll have bread and wine on the table. And you'll be thinking of Calvary and the work of Christ. At least you ought to be. I hope you're wise enough here to think of that. And you'll be taking an emblem in memory of the one who died at Calvary. And when you're breaking the bread, you'll be saying to your soul, that's for me. And you make it your own. What's that, says somebody? That's calling to remembrance the dying love of my Savior on the cross. Now remember, in a coming day, Israel will be doing the same. but they'll be doing it by sacrifices. And those offerings will just be as commemorative of the death of Christ in a coming day as the bread and wine is creative now. You know, one of those brethren who were, do you know what this means in this country? Amillennialists? Do you know what that means? Suppose you do. People who don't believe in Israel's recovery and don't believe in anything like that. And they said to me, what would they do? What would they do with 1 Corinthians 11 if what you're talking about is true? I said, look, see, we can read Leviticus 16 in our day. And what do you do with it? Well, we can see in it a picture of the death of Christ. But we know that that's not for our dispensation. And that's why we don't bring a live goat on occasions, once a year or anything like that. We have seen it all fulfilled. And we can see that. And do you think society will be more stupid in the millennium than we are? They'll know what part of the Bible to use and what part not to use. They'll be as clear on it as we are. I hope we do believe now that with all our hearts, that people in that glorious reign of our blessed Lord will be no less stupid than they are in our day. Or do you think all the brains is in this age and there'll be none in that day? I think there'll be as good and sensible people in those times as there ever were on earth before. Maybe a lot better, because they'll have no devil to mislead them. Now, I hope you're getting a hold of that. That is David's writing a psalm. It's his own experience. It's his own confession. In that, he's putting down the very lines that will be instrumental in a coming day for Israel's recovery. Oh, yeah, you have a clock here. Yes, now we'll look again at Hezekiah. Here's another man at the point of death. Mind you, good man. A good man. It was an awful blow to him. I know you people maybe don't see it this way, but I see it. For some of us have been at death's door a few times, and mind you, we know what it's like. Set thine house in order, for thou shalt die and not live. You know, there's a certain sense. Oh, you say, but sure, we're ready to die. And I just wonder that. Oh, you're ready. You're ready for heaven, but mind you, whether you're just wanting to die or not, it'd be a different story, wouldn't it? I mean, it's a big shake to any man when he has to reach out his hand and say goodbye to his dear ones and think he might never see them again. I tell you, it's no light matter. And it must have been a sad and heavy blow to Hezekiah when he turned his face to the wall. And when he didn't want to see anybody between him and God, and he was crying out in his distress. You say, now what's all that about? And he's confessing and he's humbly praying. He's not confessing, mind you, his failure. He's telling the Lord about the good things he had done. And he's seeking deliverance and mercy because of his faithfulness to God. And yet when the whole thing's over now, you listen to it. He says, thou hast cast all my sins behind thy back. He has got to the point later on where he sees that there was failure in his life for all that. Now, I know he hadn't done as evil a deed as David had done. And I know that he had been preserved from doing the many things that others have done. But he did do one thing that wasn't right. He emptied the house of God of all its wealth and treasure. And he gave it to the king of Assyria. And he stripped the very gold off the doors of the house of God. Mind you, that was grievous enough. And it's strange that that's never mentioned in Isaiah. And it comes in the historical books of Kings and so on. They've never mentioned that in Isaiah. But I want to get to the point now that's in my mind. And that is this. In that confession, he's crying to God. And he's just like, now you link it very clearly in your mind and you'll see it. If you have read, I'm sure you have, I hope you have, those wonderful passages and chapters in the prophecy of Zechariah. And you remember that they go every family apart. And every house apart, and they go and hide themselves, and they mourn, and they lament in that coming day. That's just what he's doing here. He says, we're hiding himself, and he's mourning, and he's confessing, and he's praying, and he's pleading, and he's seeking recovery. He's having an experience in the school of God that he never would forget when he was crying out in his soul's need at that time. Now, what about it, dear brethren? I wonder, do we know much about exercise before God? Do we? Have the depths and realities of need ever gripped our souls until we were just wanting to be alone and wanted to see nobody's face until the latest, as it were, would shine upon her face again. Deep exercise of heart is a reality in the life of any Christian. But you will notice, won't you, that he has in mind a day when he'll go back up into the house of God, and when he'll sing cheerfully, and sing with rejoicing, and he'll bring delight to the heart of God in that day. And of course the nation will not only be delivered, but they'll be able to sing. And they'll sing joyfully. They'll take up the songs of the Psalms and sing them with fullness of heart. Mind, there's not much song in Israel's heart at the moment. There's not. And maybe you would hardly know it, but there could be people in California, and that's a very big place, you know. I'm not too sharp on you when I come away to California for it. I don't know, many hundreds of miles. It's a big, you can put our country in the wee bit of the corner of it. But no matter, what I want is this, there are quite a few. Maybe there was a day when they were happy in the Lord. Maybe they might have been. And look at the people in California, and their hearts are sore today. They haven't sung a hymn for years, maybe. That's why I said, hope you, dear brethren, have an exercise about saints that may have drifted away from God. I was telling them in the home where I'm staying, I'm sure they're tired listening to me, but I was telling them in the home where I'm staying that we're bad at repairs. Maybe you know what that means. Bad at repairs. That is, we can work with a Christian that's doing well. Man, he's a right fella now, and we enjoy with him. But if he happens to get a bit of a broken leg, I'm speaking spiritually now, and he gets a wee bit of a knockout, we're not good at getting him recovered. We're not good at repairs. Now we should try to do a wee bit of repair work. Maybe you know somebody. There's not much joy about them. Mind you, I know them. And maybe when they'd meet you in the street, or they'd think they're going to meet you, they'd take to the other side of the road. They wouldn't want to have a, wouldn't hardly meet you. And maybe turn their face some other direction. They're just not wanting. They used to be to meet you with a smile, but they don't do that now. I was preaching in a meeting just before I came here, and there's a man in it. I'm very sorry about him, and I'm not able to explain him. But I noticed that when I would go down to the door, he was already out. He didn't want to shake hands with me. They're not doing well. We don't know what way we'll get them repaired, but mind you, we'd need to be repaired. They need to be restored. As many a child of God would need to be restored. One thing we should be greatly concerned about, now you men should be it. That is to say, we should be concerned about those who have never had the privilege of gathering to remember the Lord, who may be truly saved. Oh, you say, I don't go to their places. Now, we're not asking you to. But I wonder if we take any interest in them. I remember just after I got saved, I don't tell you stories, but you'd listen to it maybe a wee bit. After I got saved, I was the only one in the district of a young man that was saved that I knew of. But I just heard about another brother, and you know him all right by name anyhow. And he was living just a few fields from me, small fields from me. And I heard he'd got saved, but he wasn't coming near the assembly. I prayed that God would lead him to the assembly. I overtook him when we were cycling at that time. I was going to night school and he was going out. Well, I suppose he's doing the same. I suppose he's studying, I'm not sure. And I had a little talk with him. He says, I believe you got saved. He says, yes, that's right. And I said, about, do you have any exercise about the path you'd tread? Oh, he says, I'm very happy where I am. I'm in the Baptist and I intend to stay there. I said, that's all right. I didn't preach on him. I just go on praying. And after a while, I met him again. And strange enough, he was changed. God was hearing my prayers. Not because I was a great praying man, but I was praying just a young boy. And he says, I am interested in coming into the assembly, but he says, I'm not going into your assembly, into Kilmore. That's the little meeting I was in. Very small wee place. And I was wanting him to come. That's what I was praying about anyhow. See, I'm going into Lurgan Assembly. And I met him again. Oh, well, I'm very happy in Lurgan. He says, I've no exercise about any change. Aye, and I prayed on. You see, when you're a preacher, boy, I'm not at all. I never said a thing to him. Let him alone. Prayed on. One Thursday night, he came to the Bible reading. And a few nights, he came to the Bible reading. And the next thing he says, I think I'll be more useful here than I'd be in Lurgan. And he just came to the little meeting that we had. Now, you know, dear brothers and sisters, that's not a big blow. That's nothing. You know the man I'm talking about, don't you? He said, how do we know? Well, it's a Mr. John McKeon that's now in Brazil. The senior man. He's reared in the same district as I was reared in, as you all know, when we were in the same assembly. But what I'm doing, wanting to see is this. Now, it wasn't my good preaching to him. Now, listen to my brother. Now, it wasn't my great effort. I never interfered with him. I didn't even give him a booklet to show him the path. Now, maybe I should have. But I just simply prayed and prayed and prayed that God would direct his steps and that God would fill the seat that he should fill with him. Now, mind you, God's a great God, brother. Many a seat's empty around Culver City. Is that what you call this place? And I'm sure you could see many a chair filled. Wouldn't it be great if you kept praying? Individuals, maybe you know a Christian, a good God-fearing man in the area where you live, and you never pray that God would open his eyes. Mind you, we have the Holy Spirit in the people, you know. We mustn't forget that. And if he has taught us his truth, he can teach them his truth. And we ought to be exercised, deeply exercised, that others should share the favors. We have nothing in the assembly that we can say is ours and it's nobody else's. It's there for all to have. We ought to be delighted to let people share in the blessed joy of assembly fellowship. What can equal it outside heaven? I know not, and I hope you not know anything better outside heaven than assembly fellowship. May the Lord give us exercise along that line. Now, I mustn't be silly, but I will have to say a word on Jonah. Ah, oh, so somebody, yes, Hezekiah went wrong, and David went wrong, and Jonah went wrong, and they're all singing. David's singing about his sin and his failure. And Hezekiah is singing a song of gratitude about his recovery and health. And poor Jonah. Ah, you'll say you give him a piece of poetry in the middle of Jonah. Isn't that right? Isn't it in poetic form? Isn't it? It's really like a psalm, isn't it? And he's quoting endlessly from the Psalms. He has them all. Now he's not maybe directly quoting a full statement, but he's getting his language. He's full of the language of his Bible. Lets me know that he has read his Bible and has profited by it, and he's singing, and he's recovering, and he's discovered salvations of the Lord. Hope we still believe that. And he has learned great lessons inside the fish, and he has learned that being recovered and restored and brought back to God as he was, he would be able, as a missionary, to go and preach effectively. Now, we have no end of preachers, you know that. We're not at all stranded for men who have good ability and would put some of us to shame, and we're not hard to do that as far as ability is concerned. But what we want and what we need in our day are men that can preach effectively. Did you hear that? And when he went those 40 days, those days into the wilderness, into the city, and he was only there the first day's journey until there was a big move. A big move. Now, what will that mean? Now, I hope you've got a hold of this. Israel restored, he listened to it. Israel restored will be like David, they'll teach transgressors God's ways. Israel restored will be like Hezekiah, they'll be singing. And they'll be praising God, and they'll be bringing delight to his heart. And Israel, now you're listening to this bit. Israel, when restored, will be like Jonah. They'll be God's great missionaries in that coming day, in spreading the good news and bringing many into the joys of salvation. Oh, wouldn't it be great if these few meetings when we're gathered together, we'll likely never all meet together again. And if we're spared to these next 2 days, wouldn't it be great if the outcome of the whole thing would be that many would be saved, that sinners would be converted, that hearts would be opened that never thought they'd be saved, and faces would be seen sitting, remember the Lord, that we never dreamt we'd ever see in such a position. Thank God for every man I've met, and he's a wonder to himself, and he's a wonder to others, for nobody ever thought the joys of salvation would be in his soul, and nobody ever thought he would be part of a little testimony bringing glory to the Savior's name. I hope this rather childish little word at the start of the conference would be a blessing to us all.
Wisdom.
Also, you'll notice that, excuse me for going in here, but and since we're on this verse, all wisdom and with grace, you find that in verse 16. You drop down your eye down in chapter 4 and verse 5, walk in wisdom, and in verse 6, let your speech be always with grace, you have the same expressions here again, where I think that we have in chapter 4, my conduct and my testimony before the world and before the Christians. That comes, and then the idea of chapter verse 16 of chapter 3 is my testimony, or I should say my speech, as my teaching, I guess is the word I'm looking for, the way in which we teach. And so the two kind of run together. We need grace and wisdom for the both issues.
Isn't it interesting to see that there is teaching and admonishing? Some people have the idea that the only type of ministry that we should ever listen to is that devotional ministry, always presenting to us the beautiful truths of the Bible and the wonderful person of Christ and his priesthood and his kingdom glory and the features of his beautiful life and so on. Great themes, no doubt, and very precious, and they ought to have a great part in all our lives and in our public ministry. But at the same time, Paul was wise enough to know that Christians need taught and they need admonition as well. So we need a little bit of corrective attention at times by ministry. And we need to be wise enough as to appreciate that. And if it maybe goes across some of our practices, well then, let us adjust our lives to the exhortation and not resent any ministry unless it's devotional.